3, 2, 1. Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 10, Building More Resilient Organization, Why Resiliency Matters. I'm your host, Gregory Proctor, and today we have a special guest, Ms. Linda Nielsen, and we will be talking today about increasing resiliency in your organization. So, as we begin to look at our special guest, Ms. Linda Nielsen, we find that she's the founder and the president of ICOR, which is the International Consortium for Organizational Resiliency. It was established in 2005 to educate individuals on how to build more resilient organizations and communities. As an international nonprofit 501(c) organization, ICOR promotes basically framework community resiliency, which help define resiliency for both organizations and community. Linda is also a U.S. delegate in ISO TC292 series of standards. She's an expert on international standards for business continuity, management, system crisis, and communication, also community resiliency. She's also a contributing developer of ISO 22216, which is the Organizational Resiliency Principles and Attributes. In addition, she's a member of TC 268 and contributes to all standards related to community resiliency. Linda also holds a bachelor's and a master's from Northeastern University of Illinois. There we go, Linda. That's my old alma mater. Absolutely. So overall, to our listeners, she is an ambitious professional who primarily is focused on education and teaching. And I'll tell to my listening audience, since I have had an opportunity to engage with ICOR, as well as meeting Linda and learning more about resiliency and working towards becoming a resiliency advisor myself, I found that ICOR to have a tremendous depth of knowledge and affiliates and information that is out there that truly can help any community or any organization basically become more resilient. So as I indicated earlier, today we'll be learning about how to increase resiliency of your organization. Linda, do you have any opening remarks for our listeners?
Well, I just appreciate the opportunity to be on this podcast with you and to share a little bit more about ICOR and some of the things that we have that we think will help you in that resilience journey with your organization. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Linda. And we certainly appreciate you committed to sharing this knowledge with us. And hopefully some of our listeners will be able to glean some takeaways. So let's just jump right into some of the questions that I have. So Linda, can you tell our listeners more about you and how you got into the world of basically resiliency?
Sure. It's kind of, I would say my beginning of my journey was very much typical of someone growing up, a woman growing up in the 60s and 70s, which was, what are you going to be, a teacher or a nurse? So I started my education in the nursing program. And luckily, within the first few months, they had us work in a hospital, which I decided I didn't even like walking through the doors of a hospital. So I put a shut door firmly on becoming any kind of nurse and said, well, then I might as well become a teacher. But really, it's been a passion of mine my entire life. And I'd done a lot of work as a young person, both in middle school and high school, volunteering at different schools at that time for kids with special needs of all kinds. That was back in the day when those kids were not in regular schools. And so that was really became my passion from a very young age. And so that's what drove me to both get my bachelor's and my master's degree in education. And I was really driven to, I also wanted to be an administrator. I didn't really want to be a principal, but I wanted to help lead direction on where schools were going, curriculum-based, and making some of those other decisions. And I was within, you know, everybody says they're within close of getting their PhD. I was really close to getting my PhD. But I ended up having, blessed with having 4 kids in 5 years, and I put that to the side. Because while I was trying to work part-time and keep going in my degree program, the school where I was working didn't allow people to work part-time or job share. And so after working for 10 years with high school students with special needs, I did leave the industry. And it was probably the saddest day of my life at that time, was having to choose between being a mom and being a teacher. And I wanted to do both things, and I wanted to be able to do them both well. So I put that to the side and became a full-time mom for, I think I lasted 4 years doing that. But one of the things I like to, you know, what you can say when you're looking at education right now underneath this global pandemic is one of the frustrations of schools, especially, you know, the public school system, is its inability to change and how long it takes to have make change happen within that public school setting. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm even just making an assumption within private school settings as well, because they're institutions and they have bureaucracies as well. And when we look at all the changes that have happened with education during this global pandemic, I mean, it's actually really, really amazing that when people are forced to change, that they do. And so I think if I was a teacher in today's world, I would have been facing a very different scenario than I might have been facing, you know, back in the late 80s and early 90s. So I was looking for a second career. You know, I'm pretty hyperactive. I don't like to sit still much. And so just about that same time, when I left teaching, my husband was in the middle of launching a consulting company for business continuity management. That was really when disaster recovery for IT was moving to more of a holistic business continuity area. And he got a contract after I'd been working for him for a little while, doing some of the consulting and learning about business continuity, to write curriculum for a certification body in business continuity. And I'm like, well, I could do that. I know how to write education. And we laugh all the time, sort of laughing, maybe somewhat seriously, but it probably did save our marriage. They talk about people working together isn't always an easy thing. And when you have two strong people working together, it's not always easy to come home and, you know, and parent together. So that really was the kickoff of what I see as my 2.5 career, meaning, you know, I started as a consultant and that was okay for the second career, but moving into the education and curriculum development for professional development is very different than teaching kids who are forced to be in school. And so I did take more mm-hmm. classes on how to develop curriculum for professional development, how to teach the adult learner, as you might call it. And then one of the exciting things, so as we were working on that 5-year project, and we were also doing a very large consulting project for the Central Bank of Thailand. And we had a group of practitioners there that were from all over Southeast Asia and then as far north as Japan and some people from China as well. And we were the only people from the U.S. And we started looking at what we were developing for them. And we compared it to what was being developed kind of that, you know, your professional practices or your body of knowledge for business continuity. And we're like, we're doing a lot more than what's there. And we sat down and we're mm-hmm. like, so what are we doing? Like, what are the things that we're bringing in? And so we did one of those, you know, at the time, there, I don't even know if whiteboards existed yet, but we had some kind of a board we were working on. And we did kind of a brain dump on, here's all the things that we're bringing to the Central Bank of Thailand. And what would we call mm-hmm. that? And so mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. it was interesting because we didn't really have a name. But we decided to go with the name Organizational Resilience as that body of knowledge. And we were very intentional about the term Organizational Resilience because we felt we wanted to reach schools. We wanted to reach nonprofits. We wanted, you know, NGOs, as well as governments. Any model that we created, we wanted it to work for any type of organization and any size of organization. So in 2005, we founded ICOR, and that was really the beginning of what I call my third career. And as a parent of three daughters and a son, and we see how much change there are now to careers and going to college and what you're studying for. When I went to school, everybody went to be a specialist in something. You know, you became the expert. And now I see that education has become much broader, that liberal arts education really becomes very valuable, because you never know what opportunity is going to take, you know, where it's going to take you. And you really need to be open to those opportunities. And I think that's one of the things that has driven me personally, is just being able to take advantage of opportunities when they've come along. I had parents that had the same career for their whole lives, didn't change, you know, that was the way of the world back then. And I think the way of the world is a lot different now. And so we created a mission to educate. That was really our very first mission. Then we added credentialing, and we wanted to be able to lead in these resilience efforts globally. And so this mission has really become my personal mission in life, is to lead those efforts.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. Well, certainly first and foremost, very much like your unconventional path, I can share with you a little bit about my unconventional path as well. It was very much a zigzag from engineering into project controls, and now being, you know, kind of formally looking at, you know, becoming a resiliency advisor, which obviously I'm in your program, as you very well know. And I can respect that. I think you glean so much more from having divulged yourself and your talents and skills into many different aspects of organizations and business, which by the time you get to, like you said, where you want to be, it allows for you to kind of bring all of those things to one kind of central point, all fused together. And so with that being said, as you talked about, you know, your work that you guys did with the central bank and all of these different standards and various things that were going above and beyond the normal professional practices and credentializing aspects of what was happening back then. So was PMI or any type of project management body of knowledge, was that kind of utilized as the forefront for when you guys originally started with the Central Bank of Thailand? Can you kind of walk us through, you know, what type of standards you guys were using back then?
Yeah, I would say that we really started with business continuity, because that was our where we had our expertise, looking at risk management within the business continuity framework, looking at IT, what a lot of people call disaster recovery, which I like to call, you know, information and communication technology continuity, but really are evolving around those areas. And so there weren't a lot of international standards developed at that point. In fact, the first business continuity international standard was not created until 2012. So back in 2005, 2004 and 5, when we started, we really had to draw upon what we would, I guess we'd call best practices. And so while PMI and project management was a driver in how we worked, you know, using those project management principles, it probably wasn't a standard that we use as a basis, other than it became under our organizational behavior discipline in our organizational resilience framework. It became a capability or tool to use to drive some of the initiatives that we had.
Okay.
So we really started with our education programs. Ironically, we started with data center programs, writing data center curriculum, because we had several people on our team that had built and designed data centers. And so that became our cornerstone. Then we added business continuity, we added crisis management, we added some of the IT things. And those became our core services in education. And then we started certifying within those individual disciplines. And in some of those areas, we had some really stiff competition. And we still have really stiff competition within those individual disciplines. And then thirdly, we developed some models and frameworks. So like I said, when we first started in 2004 or 5, I just want you to bring back your brain and time and think about, you know, a Google search was actually more likely to be a Yahoo search. The internet was very new.
Right, right.
Earthlink was our main... email system. And when we searched organizational resilience, or we searched resilience at all, mostly what came up was things about individual resilience. You know, you have two kids growing up in the same family, or twins, and how they have the same experience, and how one takes those experiences one way and one takes them a different way. IBM had a business resilience model that they had put out that was really focused on IT systems. And we still kind of shake our heads today and say, when people talk about resilience, they still often mean your IT systems. And your IT systems are very important, but they're not the only aspect. So the first framework that we developed in 2006 was the Organizational Resilience Framework, and it looks kind of like a building, meaning that it has all these pillars. So each of those pillars, we had 10 of them at the time, and they were considered our risk-based disciplines that contribute to building a more resilient organization. We wanted people to see that they needed to be working together. In 2016, like any organization, we should also be changing and updating. We updated this framework, and it now has 12 disciplines, but they're not all the same disciplines. So we had put everything in IT in one bucket, for example, and we've now split that out where we've got the, you know, your facilities side of the technology, you've got your IT system side, and you've got your security side. That has grown a lot, so it does represent more. We also added financial health and viability, because it's very great if you can manage risk, but if you're not financially viable, just like we're seeing in this pandemic today, you know, you might not have planned for the pandemic, you might not have even had any business continuity or risk management plans, but if you are financially viable and you can manage change pretty well, you're adjusting and you're figuring things out, even if it's on the fly. And so we wanted to make sure that we had organizational behavior as a big aspect actually organizational behavior has become a large aspect of all of our models and frameworks, because it's how you make decisions. It's about your culture as well. And so those aspects we added specifically. And the theory behind the framework also was that sometimes organizations manage risk. Everybody manages risks in some way, but they oftentimes do it in silos. And the intention was to show organizations also how to integrate the management of risk and to eliminate redundancies and improve efficiency by putting managing risk. You know, you might want to call it, some people call it enterprise risk management. What we're looking at is aligned to that, but not exactly the same. But we were able to participate in the writing, like you said, of ISO 22316, which is Organizational Resilience Principles and Attributes. And that actually helped to drive some of the rewriting of our framework. But early on, we used that framework as our outline for education programs. And because I really don't believe at the time that the world was ready to understand organizational resilience. Like I said, there wasn't even a definition for it. And in fact, in 2016, when 22316 was published, I felt disappointed that it didn't go as far as it did. But the reason it didn't go as far as it did is because it took us 7 years to agree on a definition for organizational resilience globally. Because everybody had their idea. And most standards, when you publish them, already have a pretty good, people have a pretty good understanding of what the methodology is and what the mindset is. For this one, we were actually creating what it was. And so being able to participate in that was really important for us. And so that work has really been a cornerstone in what we're doing. And so we have also added crisis management communications to some of our key offerings. But the second thing that we did, because we felt that, in fact, our first tagline was building resilient communities one organization at a time, because we felt that every organization was part of a community and the community would impact the resilience of the organization, and the organizations within the community would impact the resilience of those communities. And so we reviewed it, you know, I would say between 2005 and 2007, all available research at that time about what makes some communities more resilient than others. And we created a community resilience framework. Then I was able to join, I think it was 2014, ISO Technical Committee 268 is about community resilience. And they've now moved to more about smart cities and that sort of aspects, but they have done some work on community resilience. But then we developed our community resilience framework from that. And it's what's one of the benefits. We use ISO standards volunteer work as part of our R&D to understand what people are saying globally about certain topics and to learn what models and theories that they're following. So that's what we do for that. But we really began our journey into international standards about 2011 with the business continuity Then we moved to the community resilience, the organizational resilience, and most recently in January of this year, we started on the crisis management standard, which is now being done all remotely because all of our meetings were canceled for this year, just like everyone else.
Right.
But I started from being an expert representing the United States. And at the end of 2019, I want to say probably September, ICOR was invited to lead as a liaison organization to ISO Technical Committee 292, which is the business continuity. It's the community resilience on the business continuity side. There's actually what you'll see in international standards overlap between different bodies, which is sometimes a bit frustrating. But also has emergency management, crisis management, as well as the organizational resilience work within there. And so now, instead of me serving as an individual, I'm serving as a leader of a liaison organization where we can bring in experts from all the countries in the world, and people can contribute that way. And so that's really exciting. So that's really launching this year. It's been a little bit tricky because everything was supposed to launch in June in our Berlin meeting. And since that was canceled, you know, ISO's having to adjust things as well. But we have been meeting as a liaison organization, and we submit our comments. So I have a much bigger voice now. It's instead of Linda being one voice as a group of experts in the United States, it's now ICOR has a voice of a group of experts from around the world. So we're really, really excited about that. And we have people who are helping with all of the different standards. So when we do a call for experts, and if there is anyone interested in being an expert, we can send an application. At the end, you've got our contact information. We'd be happy to go through that application process. But anyways, one of the things that we did in 2016 as an output of writing that standard on organizational resilience was we created an organizational resilience model. And it really what it did is it put a picture to what we were saying in the standard. And it identifies really the capabilities and behaviors of more resilient organizations. So as part of the research, we looked at, you know, why is it that some organizations thrive and some, like, you know, I'll give throw out, like Kodak was around for more than 100 years and it failed. So it's not just about serving, you know, being in business longevity wise. It's what were those behaviors that allowed it to stay in business for so long, and what behaviors were missing and what capabilities were missing that allowed them to fail. And there's tons of examples of that. And so looking at all of those, we put together some of those capabilities and behaviors that help organizations understand what's involved with organizational resilience, because many people believe it's just about managing risk. And what we really found is it's more than managing risk. That is really important, but it isn't the only thing that's important.
Yeah. Totally agree. And we certainly appreciate you going through the history and explaining in depth, you know, the information, particularly as it relates to the models and how they evolved and how you guys kind of set the stage for the new standard. And I'm going to segue just a little bit with my next question, because I really want to kind of tie back to the importance of why resiliency matters. And I know that as we all hear the buzzwords that are going on, recovery, resiliency, transformation. I mean, we're hearing all of these different aspects of new kind of buzzwords or terminology that's being thrown out there in the market. In your professional experience, I mean, obviously, ICOR is on the forefront of standards and resiliency. Why does resiliency matter now? What is the significance of resiliency? Can you explain that to our audience?
Yeah, I think that it's a way of operating. And you can see it at all levels, whether it's government, whether it's, you know, big business, small businesses, your different countries working together. It's how those things operate. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I found really interesting when we were creating our new curriculum on organizational resilience, really for leaders to be able to get certified, was that you find more information out by looking at things like being agile, being adaptive, how you transform, like some of the words that you were using. So when we were searching for what is, you know, what do these behaviors look like, that really presented us with some really interesting knowledge. And so when we developed that organizational resilience model, we were trying to figure out, okay, how of these things fit together? And so we looked at putting them into what I call three dimensions or three buckets of common or like-minded things. And the first one was leadership and strategy. And as you know, an organization's leadership and the strategy of the organization and how it operates is huge. And we see so often that top management and your CEOs move so quickly from one organization to another that sometimes really weakens an organization to be able to be consistent. You want them to be agile, but you also need to be consistent. So it's that balance between managing change but continuing on the path in the right direction. And so part of that then becomes your culture and behaviors. Do people really understand why you're there? Do people understand their importance in being prepared for anything that could happen to your organization as well as managing risk? And so when we looked at those three dimensions, those three big buckets, we said, okay, we need to give you some other information. And so what are some strategies that organizations can use to help increase their resilience? And this is what I think we're still in the learning phase, meaning that companies, when you say what can they do, people don't know, and they're relying on what they've known in the past, and there's change is happening too fast. And so I really think the nutshell of it is managing change. And so while you're managing change, everyone in your organization needs to have a shared vision and purpose of why they're there, which is why that's one of the strategies. They also need to be able to share information and knowledge. In talking to people who are not used to working remotely, who are now working remotely, what they're saying the most difficult thing is they're having to manage a lot of change, but they're also having to manage a lot of new information and knowledge, and they don't have systems in place to share that. So having a system in place to share information and knowledge is really essential. Of course, managing risk is important. And this idea, people often say, you know, your plan, do, check, act. Yeah, we're continually improving. It has to be how you operate to consistently being and seeking how can we continually improve. And you can't do that unless you're managing change, managing risk, and sharing information and knowledge. So those become really, really important strategies. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I was just going to say, I mean, you know, the importance, you know, at least two key points here with regards to the resiliency and why resiliency matters. You know, as you alluded to, you know, you've got leadership, but then you've got capability and behaviors that kind of contribute to an organization's ability to operate as what I would consider to be business as usual. I mean, we know that currently we're not dealing with business as usual today, and there's kind of no playbook, but certainly you have to understand those three or four factors, you know, the leadership, capability, behaviors, to be able to kind of charter, you know, or navigate your way through these uncharted waters. And certainly, I appreciate you, answering that question. It's definitely been something that I'm always tasked with as being a business owner, something that I frequently get as a question that comes across my desk from clients that we're doing programmatic efforts and building schedules for, and as they're trying to figure out, you know, how to move forward in a way that provides them with the best possible outcome on the other side of this this pandemic. So as we jump into the next question there, Linda, you've shared with us about the two models. You've talked about how ICOR kind of evolved and became kind of a global standard in the world of resiliency. And earlier on, we talked a little bit about credentializing, you know, as far as setting up programs where people can get certified. Could you explain to us kind of the three different pathways that individuals can get certified through your organizational resiliency credentializing program?
Absolutely. One of our latest initiatives is we created an organizational resilience competency model. So for any certification body, you're supposed to have what are the competencies required of the people who are getting certified by your organization. And so our first path to certification that we've had really since, I want to say, probably 2007 or 8, I think we launched it in 2008 officially, was that discipline-based approach. So we looked at our organizational resilience framework with the individual disciplines of business continuity, crisis management, data center management, and so on. And we certified within those disciplines. And then we said, if you're certified in two of those disciplines, you could be a certified organizational resilience manager. If you're certified in four of those disciplines, you would be a professional. And if you were certified in six or more of those, you'd be an executive. And what that really meant mm-hmm. is that you were taking a deep dive. You were becoming very, very, we call it our technical approach, where you've got a very deep level of knowledge of each one of those disciplines. And it's really difficult to be at the executive level because being certified in six different areas isn't that common. And you have to maintain those certifications mm-hmm. as well. But that was really the path we were going to first, because we hadn't identified what those competencies were, because we didn't have a globally accepted definition of organizational resilience. And so until we had that, sure. it's very hard to identify what the leaders of that type of effort would look like. And so what we then mm-hmm. looked at, what kinds of competencies are needed to lead, to create a good culture, and to do many other things in the organization. And we developed 25 competencies and the knowledge that's necessary for those who are really designated mm-hmm. to intentionally increase the resilience of those organizations. And then we put those 25 competencies into five clusters. So the first one's organizational behavior. And that's some of what we've talked about today, including at, by the way, actually under organizational infrastructure, includes agile project management, for example. And so one of the things we're focused mm-hmm. on with these different clusters is how can you deliver these in an agile manner? And so using agile project management as an example of how to then mm-hmm. move agile throughout your organization. And so under organizational infrastructure, we're looking at things like how your organization is structured. Is it flat? Is it tall? Is it very bureaucratic? Is it, you know, is mm-hmm. it very decentralized or very centralized? We looked at how your organization is set up. Can you work remotely? Is everybody mm-hmm. in a cubicle? Is everybody in offices? Is it an open floor plan? Is it, you know, is it one of the more where you can move from one kind of station to another? What does it look like? And does that match with the work that you're doing? We're not saying one is better than another. Mm-hmm. We're saying, is there alignment between your purpose of your, you know, and strategy of your organization with how you have people working? We also look at being able to manage facilities. When we go to preparedness and managing risk, you know, it's your typical crisis management, your incident response, business continuity, supply chain, those sorts of things. Technology infrastructure is purely looking at the technology side. And then we have continual improvement, which actually includes community resilience in there as well. And these clusters, what we're calling this is, there would be called our liberal arts approach, meaning that we want the leaders in this path that you take to have a little bit of knowledge about each of these so that they can ensure that they have the right experts in place to actually do the work. So where the mm-hmm. first one is our technical approach, where we're looking at people who have very deep technical knowledge. Our second path is really about getting a liberal arts approach and looking at making sure that you have the right experts in place to do the work. And it's really intended to help organizations' leaders to be credentialed in organizational resilience at the senior mm-hmm. or top management levels mm-hmm. of the organization. And so by identifying these competencies, we also hope that it will help those who are hiring to understand what kinds of people they need to be looking for. And not just their mm-hmm. competence, but also what kinds of behaviors that they might have. And so these are the two paths that we have for certification. We have a lot of people who literally just get certified in a single discipline and are happy with that because that's what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're just working within that discipline, and that is perfectly fine. But for people who want to grow professionally, Maybe, you know, to be more of a leader in their organization, they need to know more than their specific area. And that's where both our education and certification programs come in alignment there to help with that.
Right. Well, we certainly appreciate you explaining that. As I mentioned earlier on in our dialogue, I'm going through the program, obviously coming from a background of PMI, and learning a lot about the PMI philosophy, standards, and principles. There is a different take when you go through the I-Corps program and understand a little bit more comprehensively what it takes to be resilient. And like you said, the three attributing factors, you know, beyond the leadership, you know, there's capability, there's behavior, there's liquidity. And most importantly, I think you've chimed on this a couple times through our dialogue, is the alignment, because alignment is so crucially important. Because if that falters, then obviously you don't have proper communication, you don't have proper systems working in conjunction with one another, and things just begin to break down more rapidly. So certainly with all of that, Linda, we appreciate your explanation of I-Corps and the standards and the models that you guys have created. And we're at least for me, I'm very ecstatic about continuing to learn more about I-Corps. And so at this point, I'd like to basically kind of give our audience a few takeaways or a few recommendations that will be helpful to them, whether it's a community, whether it's an organization, whether it's individual. What would be some of the things that could help them understand why resiliency matters?
Well, I think this is a really good time with this global pandemic for people to evaluate how well they're doing, how well they're managing change, how to what level and to what extent are they able to deliver what they need to deliver. And remember that there's a lot of organizations that are taking advantage and they're seeing this pandemic as an opportunity. There's organizations that are growing rapidly right now, and those are the ones that you really want to watch. Mm-hmm. What are they doing that's different from what you're doing? And why are they able to grow and take advantage of this pandemic to grab some market share even? So one of the things that we've literally just launched in the last 2 months, and it wasn't a great time to launch something, so it's been a soft launch, is a way for organizations to measure their resilience. And it's called the Organizational Resilience Capability Assessment. And what we did was we took our organizational resilience framework, organizational resilience model, and then our capability or competencies for the individuals. We combined each of those and we put together an assessment tool that organizations can use to assess their really their strengths and weaknesses in those different areas of resilience. So we have five dimensions, and each one of those dimensions has three or more strategies. And then we also, what's really different about it is there's a lot of models out there for measuring different things. But ours is the first one that's measuring your capabilities and your behavior. So you get a behavior score for each strategy and you get a capability score. And then you combine those for your total score. And so we're looking at behaviors of more resilient organizations, such as being, like I said before, being agile and adaptive, being resourceful and innovative, being inclusive as well as collaborative. Those are some of the things you talked about, you know, getting people to stay together, working as a team, all working in the same direction, being aware and reflective. So looking ahead and looking behind, and then being both diverse and integrated. And those are some behaviors that really separate well-run organizations from resilient ones, because well-run organizations can fail. And so looking at how your organization runs itself and making sure, of course, you need certain capabilities, but you also need to behave in a certain way. And so really, we're really excited to see how this will be used to drive some of these organizational resilience strategies. And what we're really looking forward to is once we can put the pandemic behind us and we can do some research on what differentiated those companies that been successful and those that haven't, even looking at some countries, you know, why are some countries, you know, like Sweden's going in a whole different direction, being able to look and see in hindsight, mm-hmm. what has worked and what hasn't, I think will also be really, really important. Because we do know that being agile and managing change is that key underlying factor. And so looking at how your organization right now is being able to manage during all of this change, and this is change happening by the day, not, you know, not by the month or the year. It's you have to be, as we're seeing in the United States, as cities and states reopen, what does that mean? And how does that impact how they reopen? You know, I just got my dogs groomed for the first time, and it was really, it worked just fine. You know, the groomer met us outside her storefront. I handed over my dogs. Instead of walking in, I put my money in an envelope and put it through the mail slot. You know, she was able to continue operations, a single person running her business. She said she was able to run at 2/3 capacity because she kept 15 minutes between appointments instead of just loading all the dogs up and cats up in the morning. So you're operating differently, but she's figured out a way to operate and be able to make money. So we need to look at that. And I think we're going to see change happening as HR starts changing how it hires people and looking at people who can manage change. What kinds of, not just skill sets do they have, but what kinds of capabilities do they have to work in teams, to be able to lead, be able to make decisions quickly, and be able to rely on others for guidance with those decisions. Those are some skill sets that maybe aren't necessarily being sought for a lot of positions today. But lastly, I want to share with you that it's really, really important that organizations spend more time considering how the resilience of their communities impacts their organization, and not just picking a place to have your office that gives you the best tax break. Because we see now more than ever that the resilience of your community matters. Its ability to provide, and our resilient community is based on the capacity of your healthcare systems, the quality of your leaders, of its mm-hmm. of your government structure, the strength of its economy, the health of its environment, and then the preparedness of the community to meet the needs of its community members during a crisis. And so we're seeing everybody's weaknesses right now. And I think it's a really, really important time for organizations to consider not just how they operate, but where they operate, looking through different lenses for that. And so it's time for organizations to look and consider this like they haven't done before. Just like nobody planned for the global pandemic. Back when I was a business continuity person, it was always something we recommended that they plan for. People didn't want to do it. We're not going to plan for that because we're going to plan for the things that are most likely to happen. And we would always say, but yes, but the less likely your black swans that will have a big impact on you. Well, we'll worry about that when it happens. And right. it's really, right. you know, this is a tough lesson learned for all of us. And it is really during these difficult times that the strong or the more resilient don't just survive, but they prosper. And we need to understand what those are. And so looking at what is your organization doing right now to capture lessons learned and to adapt to all these mm-hmm. changes that mm-hmm. we're having. And you know, these things that could be happening until there's a vaccination, and who knows when that will be. So,
I think it's bringing to light
everything that we've been talking about for years and years. People are willing to listen, I think, finally.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very true. Very true. And I certainly, your points of looking at community, whether it's a local municipality, government leadership, you know, the ability to thrive. And you're absolutely spot on. Having family that is so diversely sparse in Europe and in South America, and understanding their stories and journeys and what they're having to endure and go through this overall pandemic crisis has been very much a heartfelt situation on a day-by-day effort. You know, not to go into any grave detail, but certainly we're very fortunate and blessed here in America that we do take certain things for granted, where other third world countries and other facilities or places in the world just don't have that luxury. And so, Linda, we'd like to definitely thank you. I'd like to leave our audience with a little bit of information if they want to learn more about iCORE. The iCore website is build-resiliency.org. And if you want to reach out to
Build Resilience. So just not the resiliency, Build Resilience. Yeah,
yeah. Build Resilience. Thank you there, Linda. I was actually thinking about my own program when I said that. So they're so closely named there. And then, of course, for the listeners that want to reach out to Linda, it is Linda, L-Y-N-N-D-A, at theicore.org. That is theicore.org. And then for those that are listening to this podcast that will be participating in the upcoming Project Control Summit, which begins on June 1st and runs through July 17th. Linda, myself, along with two other professional colleagues, will be talking and answering further questions about organizational resiliency in session 15, which will be held on July 10th. For those that have been tuned in, we hope that you've gained some insight on resiliency and what is the most important reasons why you should be considering resiliency and how to increase resiliency within your organization. And obviously, Linda, we'd like to thank you again. We'd like to wrap up this podcast and just tell everyone goodbye and have a nice day. Be safe. Take care. Talk to you soon. Greg Proctor, cut to the chase. Bye-bye.